from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. During their years at the Clinton White House, Chris Lehane and Mark Fabiani came to be known as the Masters of Disaster. They were scandal patrol experts charged with beating back the investigations, scandals, and partisan attacks that so often threatened the Clinton presidency. And for the past 12 years, they've put the skills they honed on Pennsylvania Avenue to work helping sports stars, politicians, and companies who suddenly find themselves in crisis. Now they've written a new book, along with Bill Guttentag, about what to do when you're at the center of a storm. It's called Masters of Disaster. Mark Fabiani and Chris Lehane join us next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. There are two kinds of people and two kinds of institutions, those who have been hit by a crisis and those who haven't been around very long. So begins a new book about crisis management by Chris Lehane, Mark Fabiani, and Bill Guttentag. Lehane and Fabiani are crisis management specialists, and they got the right training. They both worked in the Clinton White House, where scandal management became part of their everyday job description. It was their job to confront the investigations and confound the attackers, a task that earned them the nickname Masters of Disaster. After the Clinton years, Fabiani and Lehane founded a crisis communications firm where they've put their scandal patrol expertise to work for celebrities, organizations, and companies who suddenly find themselves in the crosshairs of crisis. Their new book is called Masters of Disaster, The Ten Commandments of Damage Control. And Chris Lehane joins us, and Mark Fabiani will in a moment. Chris, good morning.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
I want to go back 15 years to your time in the Clinton White House first in 1998 or so and ask you this. Could you have imagined at that time that 15 years later, Bill Clinton would be seen as sort of the model for a successful second-term presidency, and that Hillary Clinton would be the runaway favorite for the 2016 nomination?
Time changes things pretty dramatically, doesn't it? I come at this from someone who obviously believed enormously in Bill Clinton and what he stood for. So I always had a lot of faith and confidence in terms of him as a public servant, is one of the reasons why I worked there and why I was honored to work there. And I also got to know both the president and at the time the first lady, now the secretary of state, and you know was always blown away with their talents. So at some level, no, I'm not surprised as to where they are today because I saw them up close and personal and felt that every single day. I mean, a little bit is like the proverbial fly on the wall to history, right? And I think, you know, I always felt that when I was working for President Clinton, in particular, dealing with the scandals of the era, Whitewater, Monica, et cetera, you know, I always viewed my role in some small way as the helping him be able to do what he did so well that benefited the whole country.
What did you learn from that experience? Was it in part that you have to kind of keep your eyes on the prize? In this case, you believed in what Bill Clinton could do, so you were going to do your best to sort of sweep up after him?
That's absolutely right. At the end of the day, and one of the reasons why he was able to deal with and survive the Monica situation was because there was a broader sense from the public, really the voters, his core audience, that he was doing a damn good job as president. But for the fact that he did a very good job as president, right, that becomes a much more challenging situation to be able to survive. But he always knew, he always recognized who his core audience was. At the White House, you know, we clearly recognized that, you know, one of our defense mechanisms when everything developed and really became public, you know, was to really focus folks on the fact that you had adversaries to the president, political adversaries, who were seeking to do through the legal process and, in our view, abusing the legal process, what they could not accomplish through the ballot box. And that ultimately the president had been reelected in 1996 because people approved the job he was doing. He ends up leaving office with the highest job approval rating in modern history, at least since it's begun, since it's been recorded.
But it seems to me, in a way, you were able to accomplish that by not doing some of the things you advocate in your book about sort of full disclosure. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of your big points is full disclosure. Bill Clinton is not exactly the model for full disclosure.
No, someone asked me this the other day, and I'll use a baseball analogy. I said it's the Hank Aaron comparison, which is Hank Aaron actually hit cross-armed. He never actually swung the bat the way you're supposed to, but he was such a great talent that he was able to perform at a very high level. I mean, Bill Clinton is a preternatural talent. There are not that many people who are going to face a crisis or a challenge that are going to have the skill set that Bill Clinton has. It's a unique set of skills, ability. But, you know, the other thing I'll just add to that, right, which is that, you know, there is sometimes a perception out there that, right, there was a strategy discussion, you know, before the president went out and said, you know, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, right, that famous scene. I mean, it's not like in these – and this happens all the time in crisis. It's not like there's a big strategy session where people come up with a plan in advance of the actual event happening, right? You know, we typically would get called into a situation like that after that point in time.
So is a lesson then from this in terms of damage control, number one, don't think that you're Bill Clinton because only Bill Clinton can get away with this?
That's absolutely right. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had clients come up to me and say, well, we'll just do a 60 Minutes interview and clean this up. And I'm like, well, there's only really been one guy who's actually done that pretty successfully, and that was Bill Clinton. Yeah. No, I mean, look, stepping back, you have to put Clinton as a little bit of, you know, a special case and at any number of levels, right? But in the age that we live in, you know, we in particular live in an age where truth and trust is under assault. A crisis at its essence is a challenge to your trust or your organization's trust. And ultimately, your long-term plan has to be predicated at a fundamental level and how do you restore the trust that is being challenged.
Let's have you respond to how you would handle certain things that are very much in the news today. Susan Rice announcing yesterday that she would no longer be a candidate to replace Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. This is something that sort of has trickled out now ever since the Benghazi moment. What didn't happen that should have happened in that situation, either in terms of how the White House handled this or how Susan Rice handled it?
Yeah, well, I think that there was a fundamental point in time when the Benghazi thing, you know, became a public issue. And the White House, not the president necessarily, but the White House and other folks in the administration put out answers and representations that simply did not stand the test of time, right? Some of those answers and positions ended up deteriorating over time as more information and more facts came out. You know, that was clearly one of those situations where the White House, the administration writ large, needed to tell people what they absolutely knew, what they did not know, and then probably most importantly in that particular situation, the process that they were going to use to determine what they did not know, right? One of the things, and we talk about this in the book, right, you find yourself in a hole. The first thing you need to do is drop your shovel and stop digging. Credibility is your path back to trust, right? And if you start to put out answers that aren't tenable, that erodes your credibility and it makes it that much harder to come back. Now, I do have some empathy right there in the middle of a presidential campaign, just 3 or 4 weeks to go. You know, they may have just very well made a decision, look, we just need to get ourselves through this. You know, it may do some more longer term harm for us. But in the context of an election, it is very difficult to actually try to handle this in a way that you typically would. All that said, you know, given where the election was, given the nature of this issue, I think that they could have gone out there, been very limited in what they said. This is what we know. There's a lot of information we need to get our hands around. And this is the process we're going to do. We're bringing a team in. We're having this experts. We're having this agency. Once we have that information, we will let you know. And that would have at least protected their credibility going forward. And it was one of those classic situations where I think if you had identified a process to get to the answers, that process serves as basically a safe harbor to answer all the incoming questions.
Why don't people figure this out? I mean, in many ways, when I was reading your book, it seemed to me, you know, this
common
is pretty
sense.
Basic
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, why is it that people, do they fool themselves into thinking, well, it's not going to happen to me? I mean,
I think there's a variety of factors. I think at some level, it's like when people are asked to be their own lawyer, right? Sometimes people just don't have a perspective on what they need to do. I also think, and we see this all the time, that there is a fog of a crisis, like a fog of war, right? And And people lose a little bit of the common sense. They're very close to it. Sometimes people have never been in the situation, and so they have their veracity and integrity being challenged, and they respond. Sometimes people feel enormous pressure. We talk about this in the book, to try to stay up with the news cycles, which is always a basic mistake. You're not going to get ahead of the news cycles, and that really just puts you in the position of potentially putting information out there that then ends up not being accurate. And, you know, another aspect that we see an awful lot is what I would just call the functionality of an organization, right? We do these things all the time where major companies will bring us in advance. You know, we'll do a test of, you know, how they should deal and put with a crisis and put their protocols in place. But when the crisis actually hits, right, the people who are really the decision makers aren't necessarily the folks who've gone through the practice exercises, right? You have a CEO, you have a board, you have a general counsel. And so sometimes it's really the functionality of an organization to make the right decisions.
Is part of the problem that can occur, and this goes back a bit to the Clintons, but that is hubris. I mean, did Susan Rice underestimate or overestimate, rather, her own ability to sort of make her own case?
You know, I think you get hubris in particular with very high-level, very successful folks. I mean, at some level, people have to have a degree of hubris to be that successful, to get to where they have gotten. And we see this in particular with athletes, with elected officials, even with some CEOs. And there is that sense that, I mean, look, some of their core strengths, which make them very successful, is their self-confidence and sense that they're different. But that also puts you in a position that when you're dealing with a crisis and you somehow think that you're different and are going to be treated differently, that's inherently problematic in terms of how you analyze how you're going to deal with the problem. You know, you look at a case that we talked about in the book and is well known, the Anthony Weiner case, right? Congressman from New York who had put the embarrassing photos up on Twitter just to remind people what the situation was, right? That's an eminently survivable crisis, mm-hmm. right? Problematic, yes. Highly embarrassing, yeah. You're going to be on Jon Stewart for a week straight, yeah, all those things, right? But it's not the type of crisis where you would necessarily have to leave office and effectively end your political career if you're just straight up about it.
And beginning. Remind people what he did that you think yeah. was fundamentally an error.
Yeah, no, great question. Which is he did – initially his office put out statements that denied that it was him. His office then raised the possibility that his Twitter account had been hacked. He then did the infamous Wolf Blitzer CNN interview where he, you know, asserted that there may have been some type of hacking, denied that it was him, right? These are some basic questions, right? Is that you in the photo? Did you send the photo? Right? I mean, these are questions that he ought to have been able to answer. And, you know, he ended up putting himself in a position where it was because he lied about it and made just basic misrepresentations that caused him to lose support from people in Congress, support from major political figures. And at that point in time, he really didn't have a choice, but he had to resign.
And you contrast that in part with the story of Eliot Spitzer, yep. who in many ways was found to have done something far worse. But by saying, yep, I did it. No excuses, and I'm going to resign, has in a way already achieved a degree of rehabilitation former Congressman Weiner is a long ways from achieving.
That's right, right? So you end up in one of these situations where your reputation is being challenged in a really serious way, and you're absolutely right. Governor Spitzer had a much more serious situation than Congressman Weiner, but by going out there, taking responsibility, apologizing, acknowledging that he at least put himself in the position to be able to have a comeback with a sense that this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. And I would just add in, I think we're seeing one of those situations right now in front of us with the General Petraeus situation at the CIA, right? Similar situation, right? Highly embarrassing conduct he shouldn't have been engaged in. But he didn't go out there and try to fight it, deny it. He acknowledged it, resigned. And now he probably puts himself on the Eliot Spitzer track, right? He can teach, maybe have a TV or radio program. Maybe he does a movie at some point, right? But he clearly puts himself in a position where, you know, people at least believe that he is a trustworthy person in terms of how he handled the situation.
Chris Lehane, our guest this hour. He, along with Mark Fabiani and Bill Guttentag, are the authors of Masters of Disaster, The 10 Commandments of Damage Control. And we'll work our way through some of those 10 commandments. How do you convince someone, though, that they need to be that, hey, the genie's out of the bottle, you got to be straight up about this? Because you can imagine Anthony Weiner or Eliot Spitzer or whoever saying, I just can't go there. I cannot acknowledge this. I can't have a press conference and say, yep, it was me. How do you tell them, look, you got to?
Yeah, and part of it is, you know, you have to speak very straight with folks. you know, we at least have the background and our own personal credibility of having been involved in enough of these situations so that oftentimes we're actually brought into situations where folks who are advisors to a CEO or an athlete or a political figure are actually giving that person the right advice. But we're brought in, you know, from the credibility perspective of here's some guys who've dealt with this and they can tell you how this is going to play out. And you have to have a very straightforward, hard conversation with folks. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, we've talked about the fog of the crisis. There's also the emotional issues that come in. Sometimes someone realizes that objectively they need to do X, Y, and Z as is being recommended, but they're really concerned about how their spouse is going to feel about it. End of the day, the spouse is going to find out about it either way. So let's do this in a way that puts you in the strongest possible position going forward. But you know, those are sometimes exceptionally difficult conversations to have. Sometimes you almost feel like you're a therapist as you go through the process, because it really is trying to explain to people, you know, what the consequences are if they don't. And you know, sometimes we really just boil it down to this basic formula, which is, you know, what you, client X, need to consider if you don't do this. What is the worst possible consequence? And if the worst possible consequence is that you cannot survive, then you need to look at the path that we have recommended, which is getting out there, getting out in front, disclosing, understanding what you need to do to maintain your credibility and ultimately protect your trust.
Another example that you use, and then we'll move on to some of your other key components to surviving disaster, is the difference between Magic Johnson and Tiger Woods.
Mm-hmm. Kobe Bryant and Tiger Woods, yes, which to us was a really interesting compare and contrast, right? So Kobe is facing a situation, a criminal indictment, you know, potentially doing, you know, jail time for the conduct in Colorado, where there was an allegation by a woman that he had assaulted her, whereas Tiger had a situation involving, you know, whether or not he'd had some affairs. And you know, Kobe gets out there relatively quickly, does a very well-known press conference with his wife, takes responsibility, acknowledges that he had an affair, but then draws a line between the affair and the criminal conduct. And by going out there quickly and affirmatively, he gave himself the sort of the credibility, the pivot moment where he could really draw a distinction between the conduct he did and the conduct he was saying he did not engage in. And that allowed that pivot moment by going out there and acknowledging what he did do gave him the ability to begin to raise questions about the person who was accusing him on the other side, and he had a basis for doing so. Whereas Tiger, who has a much less significant situation, right? He's not facing criminal exposure, you know, takes, you know, more than 3 months before he holds that very famous sort of semi-press conference.
In which he says nothing.
Yeah, right. And over that period, you saw the deterioration of what at that time was one of the world's great
brands.
I mean, I've seen polling data that has indicated that over the course of that time, he went from having one of the top five brands in the world, a global brand, to one of the two or three worst
And may never be recoverable.
Now, with sports athletes, a little bit of it is somewhat related to can they come back and perform.
Right.
But, you know, you think about where Kobe ends up. Kobe ends up, you know, a year later with his jerseys and his endorsements being amongst the top in the NBA still, you know, and Tiger obviously had an enormous degradation of his brand. I mean, there's another thing, right? The New York Post set the record for the most times they ever put someone on the front page, you know, that's called The Wood, right, which is the front page of the tabloid. I mean, I think it was something like 30 straight days. I may have the number a little bit off, that Tiger Woods was on the cover of the New York Post with all sorts of very unflattering headlines.
I mentioned the comparison with Magic Johnson and Tiger Woods, and I'd forgotten that in your book it's the Kobe Bryant Tiger Woods. But you do reference Magic Johnson as an example of someone, especially in that time when you think about this, almost 20 years ago, that he and talk about someone whose brand is still at the peak.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. Which is, you know, Magic came out and publicly acknowledged that he had AIDS. Explained, you know, what he had done, including having affairs in terms of how he had contracted the disease, but was very upfront. And you're so right. I mean, we talk about it now. It's a very different time period. But, you know, in the early 90s, I mean, I remember exactly where I was, and I think a lot of people do, when that became public.
Yep.
I mean, people were just absolutely, you know, shocked by it. But because Magic was so upfront about it, because he held his head high and also took responsibility for his personal actions vis-a-vis his wife, but really explained the situation. You know, he ended up engendering enormous sympathy and empathy And at some level, his brand is even stronger than it may have been at the time. And it's really an amazing story just to see how Magic Johnson handled what was, in comparison to a Tiger Woods, a far, far, far more difficult situation. And also just think of the emotions that Magic is dealing with. I mean, at that time, right, people thought that that was going to be effectively a death sentence. And to get up there and handle it the way he did, Magic may sort of fall into a little bit of the Bill Clinton category, which is a unique talent, a unique ability to connect with folks. But still, it's an amazing story.
Chris Lehane, co-author of Masters of Disaster, The Ten Commandments of Damage Control. And Chris's co-author, Mark Fabiani, joins us now as well. Mark, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
One of the things we were just talking about in terms of the value of full disclosure is something you talk a lot about in the book. And along with that is this, that you have to be very sure of the details. The details matter when you come forward. Say something about that, if you would, Mark. That if you're dealing with one of these situations and you're going to disclose, you need to make sure, because I think you say in the book something like you only get one bite at the disclosure apple, so that you have to be precise about it and not and to make sure that nothing you say is going to come back and bite you back.
That's right, and that may be the single most difficult challenge that people who are managing crises face, because in this day and age, as you know, there is so much pressure with constant news cycles. There used to be a 24-hour news cycle. Now the news cycle is a minute long, and then the next minute, and the next minute. And there's so much pressure to put out information when something happens. And yet, when you put out information and it turns out not to be true, even if it was an inadvertent mistake on your part, you thought it was true, but it turns out it wasn't, you've cost yourself the one advantage that you hope to have in a situation like this, and that's your credibility.
One of the examples,
once you lose that, it's gone.
One of the examples you write about is Meg Whitman in her gubernatorial campaign here in California, and that she could never seem to quite get the details right, whether it was the questions about her past voting record or whether or not she had hired an undocumented worker. It was like they weren't careful enough or didn't do their homework well enough. How common is that problem?
It's very common, and it's because people feel the pressure from calls they're getting, whether it's calls from the media, calls from major investors, calls from people who care about the company and want the company to say something or do something, or a candidate to say something or do something. And oftentimes, you have to resist that pressure. And if you get beaten up for a day or two and then come out with facts that stand the test of time, that's really the way to do this, not feel so pressured that you say something that you might believe to be true but turns out not to be true later.
We have to take a break in just a moment. But on this point, Chris Lehane, is that where it's important to make sure you don't overstate your case? Even if in your own memory, I didn't hire an undocumented worker. You have to be really careful about avoiding absolutelys and never did this,
yep.
So that you make sure you only say what you really know you can say.
That's absolutely right. And, we typically go through this process with a client where they will really want to state something in unequivocal terms, and we will pull them back and work through sort of stripping down their response. And we often talk about that in these situations, less can be more, because you're playing a long-term game here, and stating something in an unequivocal way or putting out an absolute is like waving the red flag to the bull. You almost know that that's going to be challenged, and then you're basically putting your credibility on the chopping block and rolling the dice when you do not need to.
So it's disclosure, but it's disclosure that's carefully scripted.
That's exactly right.
Chris Lehane and Mark Fabiani join us. Their new book, along with Bill Guttentag, is Masters of Disaster, The Ten Commandments of Damage Control. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we will take your calls at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. If you're in the middle of a crisis of some sort, how did you deal with it? What were the challenges that you faced? What sort of advice would you like to get from either Mark Fabiani or Chris Lehane? We'll take your calls when we return. You can email us as well at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guests this hour, Chris Lehane and Mark Fabiani. Their new book, Masters of Disaster, The Ten Commandments of damage control. We also want to note that we will be having additional coverage on public radio of the shooting at a Connecticut elementary school today, which left 27 people dead, including 18 children. We'll be going to NPR for more coverage of that and Talk of the Nation coming up in less than a half an hour. So we will be getting to that story over the course of time this morning. Again, shooting at a Connecticut elementary school this morning left 27 people dead, including 18 children. More from NPR News coming up at the top of the hour. When you hear that kind of story, obviously it puts everything that we're talking about in such a different context. Chris Lehane, have you contended with how, in a crisis of that order, what's important for public officials to be able to come forward and say, is it this fundamental rule of sort of what we know and what we don't know, being precise about detail?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, I'll just say, obviously, we're just learning about what happened, and it just sounds just awful. You know, I was with Al Gore when we went to Columbine about 24 hours after what had transpired there. And, you know, to this day, it is probably one of the most impactful things that, you know, I have ever seen, to see the families and what they went through. And as a public official, you know, dealing with a situation like that, you know, you're absolutely right. You have to be obviously showing empathy and sympathy, and a big part of it is just physically being there and demonstrating that. But you do also have to be exceptionally careful about saying what you do know, and in particular what you do not know, because those are situations that are evolving so quickly. And people are listening to everything that you say so closely. You know, that you have to be exceptionally careful about how you're positioning and representing things.
How does one do that, Mark Fabiani? And when you're in that sort of literally life and death crisis where things are changing of the moment, it would seem like you would have to have the ability to both be fully able to disclose everything you know, but at the same time sort of be editing yourself simultaneously. What skills do public officials need to draw upon in this sort of crisis?
Well, as you can imagine, it's incredibly difficult, especially in a place like this, a small town where, you know, the police chief woke up this morning not expecting to have to do anything like this, and all of a sudden he or she is facing a barrage of questions about things that happened. But you just have to be, despite that, you have to be disciplined and only tell people what you're sure of, and not and resist the pressure to tell them things that you think might be true, which will only then create more rumors. You know, things sort themselves out in time, and you've got to be able to have the discipline to give the situation time to sort itself out. And in the end, you will have done your job if you can manage that. But of course, under these circumstances, it's one of the most incredibly difficult things you can imagine.
And I would just add in, you know, we touch on a couple of examples in the book. You know, most important thing is you have to keep the focus on the people who have been hurt and the families, right? You don't necessarily need to put yourself in a position where you're beginning to answer a lot of the questions. As Mark said, there will be time, but you can say that. You know, our focus right now is on doing everything we possibly can to support these families. We're going to get to all these questions. They're good questions. Right now, our focus is on them, and that's what we're going to focus on. And, you know, Mark, I think, had to deal with, you know, situations like this when he was a deputy mayor of L.A., I think over the course of some of the riots that took place down there. And Mark, I think you had to deal with this in real time in those situations.
Yes, and it's something that, you know, when people are being harmed, obviously, you're worried about that first and foremost. And, you know, that has to take precedence, and people have to understand that. And if you're not able to answer a particular question, that's just the way it has to be. And you've got to be able to stick with that until you have an answer that you're sure of, and until you've taken care of the top priorities, which, as Chris just said, is taking care of the people who have been harmed.
Who, when you think about these kinds of grave crises, who's done it particularly well? And by it, I don't mean, you know, in the end, something that's benefited them from a career standpoint or spun things in the right way, but just was fundamentally and humanly and from a leadership standpoint, did exactly what was needed.
Yeah, I will touch on one, and I think Mark can probably talk about Mayor Bradley in L.A., who I think was a great example. But, you know, Bill Clinton, after the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, politically for him was actually the beginning of the last 6 years of the Clinton administration, where people perceived him as being very capable at what he did. But in that moment, he was just so good because, I mean, one of Bill Clinton's great strengths is his ability to empathize and connect with folks. And that was just part of his DNA. And in those several days around Oklahoma City, again, this is going back 20-some-odd years, so people may not have as fresh a recollection, but that was just a startling event. And to have him play the empathizer in chief and not do anything that was going to – because there were all sorts of profound public policy questions, right? What did the FBI know? You know, how do we have these acts of domestic terrorism? What does it say about our country? All big and important issues, which ultimately he addressed when he gave the talk down there in Oklahoma City. But he did it in a way where, A, he didn't do anything that was going to compromise his credibility or what the government stood for, but also did it in a way where clearly people understood he was trying to wrap his arms around the people of Oklahoma City and broadly our country. And I think, Mark, Mayor Bradley was phenomenal in the situation that you dealt with.
Yeah, the tremendous civil unrest in Los Angeles in 1992, even before the fires were out, the mayor was on the phone with people planning the rebuilding, recruiting Peter Ubroth to head the organization to rebuild L.A., on the phone with the president and the governor and major leaders of the Hollywood studios in Los Angeles and rounding up support and money. And he just didn't stop doing that. His concern was to fix things. And people, I think, saw that and they appreciated that. Even though it was an incredibly difficult time, I think they saw that his concern was for the people who had been hurt and how things were going to be made better.
Rudy Giuliani comes to mind as someone else who seemed to be draw upon the right inner strength at a time of need. Let's go to a caller. David in San Francisco joins us. David, go ahead, please.
Yeah, how are you? I'm glad that you've been able to merge this incident in Connecticut with the way that your guests were advertised, so to speak. I in hearing about what happened with the shooting in Denver, the Batman movie shooting, the gun lobby apparently made massive sales. They actually spun the story in such a way that they were able to, I'm not sure if they tripled or quadrupled sales, but the sales of guns and ammunition went up exponentially. And I'm just wondering how they're able to pull that off.
David, thanks. Chris, you have a response?
Yeah, I'm not a particular expert on the gun sales issue. What I do know, and I remember this a little bit from Columbine and some other incidents, is that typically when one of these situations arise, there is, at least within some segment of the population, a belief that they need to arm themselves. And so I think that's a pattern that has happened in the past. I would also say, and again, Denver was a huge tragedy. This just sounds awful the more we learn about it. Both situations, there is going to be a huge public debate and discussion on the gun issue. And I do think that both those, certainly the Denver situation, and I anticipate this situation, is going to probably embolden and empower those who want to have stronger laws on guns. I mean, you saw Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York after Denver, really step out in a big time way. And actually ended up funding a super PAC around the country that specifically focused on supporting candidates who were willing in competitive districts who were willing to take a brave and courageous stand on the gun control issues. And so I think you're going to see some of that play itself out.
We're importantly and I think appropriately veering some from the focus of your book. But given the news of the morning, I want to ask you also, Mark Fabiani, how you would advise a candidate or a public leader who wants to be bolder on this issue. This seems to be the sort of, we often say Social Security is the third rail of American politics, but in many ways it seems like gun control is even more so. If someone said, come hell or high water, I'm now going to go after this, how would you advise that person to pursue that stance?
Well, it's amazing that, other than Mike Bloomberg, no one has really stepped out and taken that position.
Including the president. I mean, it hasn't been something that he's been willing to tackle.
It's just, I don't know what it would possibly take to convince an elected official to take steps forward. If not today, I don't know that anything could convince someone. But it seems like there's an incredible opportunity to try to do some good in this country by taking a leadership stand that may in the end cost you You may get voted out of office if the gun lobby rallies against you, but, you know, there's a chance to really change the dialogue on this if people are willing to have the courage to do it. Unfortunately, at least so far, and that's before today, you haven't seen a lot of that other than from the mayor of New York. You haven't seen others of that stature out there, and maybe that'll change, but you know, I'm not holding my breath on that. I think it's unfortunate, to say the least, that people do not show the leadership on this that they should.
I think that there is a perception, and I think it is inaccurate, at least among some Democrats, that, you know, the gun issue or taking a courageous stand on this can really imperil you politically. Yes, you can certainly point to some races where that's taken place, but I would contest in almost every single one of those races, if you actually go and look at what was going on the ground there, those were races where the Democrat was probably not going to win under any circumstance. The NRA has done an enormously good job of framing this issue as a way that's politically. So I think – so for me, Democrats have to actually take a step back and recognize that at the end of the day, right, this is a courage issue. You have to do the right thing. You have a president now who – Robert Caro in his book about LBJ has this line that, you know, power exposes, right? Power can expose good things. This is a president who's not running for re-election. This is an issue now. You've had two of these situations, you know, since he's been president. This is a time and an opportunity for him to really step out there on this.
Well, let alone what happened with Gabby Giffords in
Arizona. Yeah, that's right.
There's
multiple situations.
But let me ask this the other way around. Doesn't it also require people like you guys to be more courageous and to advise candidates, if you were still in that business, in a different way, to say not go with what the polling say, not go with what seems to be cautious and the sure way to win, but to really sort of focus more on what the country actually needs?
No, I think that's 100% right. And I know Mark and I have had this discussion a number of times. You know, I am a big believer that we live in the age of authenticity, where at the end of the day, you know, it's much better to have an authentic brand and people to actually believe that you're going to do the right thing, or at least what you believe in, even if at times that means taking on issues that you know are not necessarily publicly supported. Because the long-term takeaway from that is that you are someone that they can trust who's going to make a decision that they think is the right decision. And to me, we live in a day and age where trust is at all-time lows across virtually every sector of society, business, politics, religion, the media, right? And so folks who really understand that they can be trusted because they stand up for what they believe in my view, are the types of politicians who are going to succeed long-term. So you have a Mayor Bloomberg who takes on issues in New York. Andrew Cuomo, the most popular governor in the country right now, because he's been willing to take on issues that historically governors had not. You know, former Mayor Newsom in this city, now the lieutenant governor, you know, took on the gay marriage issue long before, you know, most politicians were willing to do. And going forward, he's always going to have a courage brand for doing that I think serves him well politically.
Chris Lehane, Mark Fabiani, their new book is called Masters of Disaster, The Ten Commandments of Damage Control. We're reorienting our program to a degree because of the news out of Connecticut again this morning that at a Connecticut elementary school, a shooting left 27 people dead, including 18 children. We'll have more about this story coming up at the top of the hour on NPR News and on Talk of the Nation. And we invite your calls on this subject really now of leadership, I think, and what people need to do in crises, both as leaders and as citizens. If you want to join our conversation, have thoughts on this, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. You can also post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website. Mark Fabiani, where do you see opportunity? You were saying a moment ago that you wouldn't hold your breath, but do you think that in terms of restoring trust, that it's really going to take people now being more courageous about whatever the issue happens to be, whether it is something like this that we're talking about, gun control, but about being honest about what we're doing with entitlement reform? There seems to be such a dearth right now of being candid and straightforward about those things, in part, I guess, because people don't believe it's going to win them or be a winner for them. Where do you see that? I think now we're sort of caught up with that in these fiscal cliff, that no one seems willing to sort of come out and say what needs to be said.
You're absolutely right. And it's because people tend to fight the last battle over and over again. I think, you know, the Republican presidential campaign this year was, you know, fighting the last election and trying to win on those rules, while the Obama campaign was fighting the campaign of the future. And I think you've got to do the same thing in politics if you want to make a difference. You've got to put aside the canards, if you will, that the NRA is going to mobilize and throw you out of office and that you can't take on these third rail issues. As Chris said, people do take them on, and they're in their limited way, they're very successful. Andrew Cuomo, Mike Bloomberg, I think that's what some people admire about Chris Christie in New Jersey, you know, his willingness to say something that sounds candid and straightforward. And so there's clearly a model there for people who are willing to throw away the old playbook and do things differently. And I think, as Chris said, in a time when people are craving leadership and they're craving authenticity, there is an opportunity there for someone, whether that's Cuomo or someone else in the next 4 years, to really seize that mantle of a person who's willing to do what's right no matter what the political consequences are.
Latest from AP on the shooting, that students and staff are among the victims at the Connecticut Elementary School. The shooter responsible for those 27 deaths this morning is dead. That's the latest from AP. We'll have more on this. NPR will have special coverage starting at 11 o'clock this morning, hosted by Guy Raz. So stay tuned. Coming up in just 13 minutes, there'll be an NPR special on this ongoing tragic and developing story. I think of Chris Christie, and it wasn't during Hurricane Sandy, it was a storm before that, where he just said, you know, get off the damn beach. People need to evacuate. Why is that so hard for people to get the fundamental appeal of having leaders who actually tell the truth?
I think that part of it is just the political process and how people come up through the political process, right? They're sort of taught to do things in a certain way. It generates a central sort of conservatism, not ideologically, but just sort of a conservative approach. They always want to be cautious. They always want to be safe. But, you know, I take a step back and pick up on something that Mark was touching on, right? We talk in our book about the different elements that contribute to why we live in an age of crisis, or why trust is always being challenged. And one of them we talk about is what I call the huge negative feedback loop, right, which is you have a skeptical or a cynical press, broadly defined, providing information to a very skeptical public, which then goes back and forth and bounces off one another, creating this huge negative feedback loop, which then contributes to the paralysis that currently exists out there in a time period when this country faces enormous challenges, where ultimately you actually do have to trust some of these institutions to be able to take on these issues, right? And so if you look at the gun control issue, right, there ultimately has to be some trust that government can do stuff to keep people safe. But it's difficult to actually get to that place where people are willing to invest the trust in government to do that because of this enormous negative feedback loop. And I think that's – we've had times of paralysis in our country. I mean, Reconstruction before the Progressive Era, even during the end of the Eisenhower era, beginning of the Kennedy era. But not with this type of negativity out there, not with this levels of distrust in society. And I think that is a huge challenge for us going forward.
And of course, you can't have this conversation without focusing on the role of media and journalism, and our own tendency to sort of leap from crisis to crisis to crisis and focus on things that aren't necessarily important enough, that we don't focus on what is important and instead get distracted or don't fully. I guess, Mark, I'd like your thoughts on this. You know, when the shooting in Oregon happened just 48 hours ago, it seemed to just kind of glide through. I mean, it didn't. Are we not oriented enough, in your experience, with really taking chances on the reporting side of this, on being willing to really invest in what matters most?
Well, you said the right word there, invest. Given the economic pressures that all news agencies are facing and have been facing for many years, it's very difficult to invest the resources in a story that, even though it may not be consistently on the front page every day, is something that you spend time pushing along as if it were an agenda for a news organization. You don't see that anymore. You used to see it. News organizations would pick up an issue that was important to them, and they would write about it no matter whether something was going on or not. And that would create change. But you don't see that anymore, because I think you don't have the economic flexibility to do something like that. You've got to cover what's going on today, and then whatever happens tonight, you've got to cover, and tomorrow, and the next day, and the day after that. And I think it's a real negative development in our country, that the pressure that news organizations have been under here economically.
Let's go to Patrick in Half Moon Bay, who has a thought he wants to share this morning. Patrick, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
I've lived in the country for 30 years, and I've never seen endemic cynicism as high as it is right now across, you know, across private industry, across the public sector. And I think we've got to revise what our values are and what we define as success, because it seems to me that a lot of what we consider as success now is mutually exclusive with what integrity, honesty, and compassion require. And I'll just say that and nothing more.
Patrick, thanks. Thank you for offering that. So it's a useful point that this you know, we're pointing at leadership and what leaders need to do, but it's a responsibility that falls across society.
Yeah, it does. You know, you had asked earlier, you know, how you deal with having a conversation with a client or an entity when they're dealing with a difficult situation. And I would say that one of the defining characteristics that I think we've experienced is that there are certain companies, certain individuals that have real values. And when you have that conversation with them, they get it really quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, they almost start finishing your sentences. They understand what you need to do because it's consistent with their values. The harder conversations are with those folks or entities who potentially don't share those values. So, you know, at an individual level, it plays out that way. But I also go back to what we were just touching on earlier, which is you look at the issues we face and you have the fiscal cliff in the short term, or immigration issues, right? Climate change issues, national security issues, equality issues in terms of the American. I mean, these are huge challenges that our country faces, right? And to address those, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, there has to be some faith and confidence in the ability of your leaders and of your government institutions to take them on. And if you don't have faith and trust, then that becomes an inherently problematic situation because we have to deal with these issues. They're not going away. And if we don't deal with them, it's going to be very, you know, very damaging to our country and to the next generation. And that to me is really, you know, causes great. It's one of the reasons why we're in this era of crisis, because people do have such high levels of distrust, but it also has profound implications for the country we live in.
Also reminds me, before you joined us, Mark, we were talking some about the chapter in your book where you talk about sort of being in a fog when it's crisis, like the fog of war, that you're sort of overwhelmed. And it occurs to me, as we're learning more about this story in Connecticut this morning, I mean, talk about a fog. I'm sure the people who are having to contend with that in Connecticut are deep in that, but this is a time where you have to be all the more clear and sure about what matters most, right? About your values. I mean, do you work with people it sounds sort of rudimentary, but for starters, you got to know what matters. You got to know what your values are.
That's very well said. And in a situation like this, the fundamental value is to take care of the people who have been harmed. And that's what you can always and should always go back to. No matter if people are pestering you about questions about exactly how it happened and how many people were involved, things that you might not yet know the answers to, you don't have to answer those. You have to keep going back to what's important, keep going back to what's the fundamental value. And if you remember that in any kind of crisis, I think you'll be well served.
And is this also where you've got to make sure that you get the details right?
Yes. Or moreover, you don't put details out that end up not being tenable or sustainable, right? This situation, you need to respond with overwhelming force in terms of the message, right, which is the empathy message. You need to have a sense of who your core audience is, right? The core audience are the people in your town, the families, and then it sort of, you know, flows out from there. And then absolutely, you know, you just every single question that you get, every single action that you take, every single thing that you do needs to be through the prism of, is this a credible, is this consistent with what we're focused on here, which is talking to the families and supporting the families? And as long as you do that, right, you're going to generally be okay over the long term. It's when you start to deviate from that you potentially create longer term problems for you. I mean, look, what has happened, right? Issues are going to come out. The police department, others are going to have to deal with those. But you deal with those, you know, over the long haul. And ideally, you put in place a process to be able to deal with them in a credible way.
You write in the book, Mark, about this phrase that Chris just mentioned about responding with sort of full force. That doesn't necessarily mean that you sort of pull out every possible weapon that you have, but it does mean you have to be really there. You have to be present. You can't just sort of say, oh, this will go away, like John Kerry did with the Swift boating example. You need to be, and in this case, the crisis in Connecticut, whoever is in charge needs to be there, needs to be front and center and responding, right?
Absolutely. And just imagine how difficult that is for someone, particularly in a smaller town, that never expected to face something like this when they got out of bed this morning. So it's an incredible thing to have to deal with. And it's amazing how well people in these situations end up dealing with them on the whole. People do make mistakes, but you know, on the whole, these are situations where people rise to the occasion. And I hope that's the case here as well.
Let's take a quick thought from Zelma. Just briefly, if you would, Zelma, we're short on time.
Yes. If somebody really willing and ready to stand up against gun control, towards the lobby, the gun lobby, they need to decide inside, am I willing to give my life for this? Because that's what needs to be decided. I'm not saying that person necessarily will be killed, but dealing with gun issue, that's the level that the commitment needs to be.
Yeah, Zelma, thank you. You said earlier, Chris Lehane, that crises, you know, reveal something about leadership. Just a last thought, if you would, on that, for when you're in a difficult crisis and you need to respond, whether that's the situation that's evolving this morning in Connecticut or something that is not nearly as disastrous and horrific as this one is, what do you counsel people to sort of go deep inside to think about so that what they're able to contribute and reveal is something that that contributes rather than detracts from whatever the situation is?
That's right, right. So, you know, we have this conversation. We would say, you know, look to your left, look to your right. Both those folks are going to face a crisis, but look in the mirror because you are. And what is it going to say about you to the people that you care about, to the audiences that you care about? Right, a crisis is a challenge to your trust. It's also an opportunity for you to demonstrate what you stand for, who you are, what you believe in. And if you keep that in mind, if you keep in mind that this is a long-term process, you're going to be well-positioned.
Chris Lehane and Mark Fabiani, along with Bill Guttentag, their book, Masters of Disaster, The 10 Commandments of Damage Control. Thanks both very much for being part of our conversation this morning.
Thanks.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Danny Bringer, our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. Please stay tuned for special coverage of the shooting in Connecticut. It'll start right after the top of the hour at 11 o'clock, hosted by Guy Raz. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.